Accession number 9168, rule number 6.
Mr. Amat, rule 6. Were you given any treatment for your condition whilst you were still in France?
Yes, the only treatment we got was, some aspirin crystals. There was no sort of tablets in those out. You laid your head back and put your tongue out, and the orderly sprinkled a few aspirin crystals and gave you a drink. And that's all, the only treatment I had, barring the fact that I wasn't given any square meals. I was only on sort of light meals.
Did they diagnose your condition?
Yes, trench fever. That was on the card which I had, which I kept all the time whilst I was in hospital until I got to Southampton, telling the people who received me and other people what was wrong so they knew what to do. When we arrived at Southampton, we were met with a number of ladies who were, I believe, belonged to the what is now the women's organisation, and they had tables set with tea, urns of tea, and cakes and cigarettes, and these were all handed round, and then we were taken to the railway station and boarded a train which took us up to London. We arrived at, Victoria, and there we were taken out, and there was an officer there with a roll of all the people on the train, and he called out these names, and I found myself going to a hospital, which was in Chelsea, and we're taken there by a Rolls Royce open car, me and some more chaps, and we arrived at this large house converted to a hospital, and this was run by the voluntary nursing organisation. All the nurses were all local ladies who were volunteered for the job, and I was given the same treatment there as normally I'd had, just aspirin and light meals. And one of the things I'd like to say about this is the fact when I got there, all our clothes was taken away and we were given hospital clothes. In those days, all the armed forces when in hospital were put into these hospital clothes. It was a pale blue trousers and pale blue jacket, and a white shirt and a red tie, so you could be seen a mile off that you were a hospital patient. I don't know what the idea was, but it seemed to bring quite a lot of compensations, because if you went out, people would buy you a drink or give you cigarettes and that sort of thing.
You weren't confined to the hospital?
Yes, I was confined to the hospital and was kept in there in bed for several days, but then I was allowed up after lunch. And whilst I was there, it was these ladies who were the nurses that used to take parties of us home to their houses by car and for tea and entertainment. I went once or twice, and it was rather edifying, really, because I had never been in any large house before with these well-to-do families, but they were quite nice to us and gave us anything we wanted. One trip we had that was organised by the nurses was I was taken by car to Richmond, and there we boarded a paddle steamer and were taken up the river to, I think it's called Marlow, several miles up the river in this hole. And when we got there, it was a nice sunny day. Tea was laid on for us, so we took tea there. But coming back, I came over unwell again, and they took my temperature and found out I was about 103 again, so I was taken back and put into bed again for another few days. I spent about 3 weeks in this hospital, and then I was posted to a convalescent camp in Sussex called Seaford, little town of Seaford. It was just outside this camp. It was a large hutted camp, and it was run by the Guards Division. I remember that the name of the commanding officer was Lord Glanusk. He was the commandant of the camp, and he was also a general in the on the general army list. Anyway, while we were there, although we had to be very smart on parade, we never used to do much work at all or drill. You only had to parade, but to as the guards were running it, we had to carry out their duties and all that, the same as the guards. So when you were inspected by the officer every parade, you're supposed to have a crease down your trousers and look smart, and everything got to be right in good order. But we used to be taken on leisurely marches down to the beach. The camp was in a high position, several hundred feet above sea level. We used to march down there, and then in the morning, sometimes after breakfast, and left there all morning until it was time to go back for lunch. Then we go back and we prayed again, but then unless there was anybody detailed for any fatigues or duties, we had the rest of the day to ourselves. Anyway, whilst we were there, the security in this camp was very lax, and everybody had been out to France or some other theatre of war, and everything was all free and easy, so that nearly everybody in the camp used to slip off for going home to their wherever they live without any pass at all. The only thing is, it was a general joke that if you got caught, you were unlucky, because after Friday night, there was never any particular roll call. People used to all sort of take it easy, and it was quite usual for the men in the camp to walk a few miles out of the area of East Seaton and board a train in one of the small stations, so where there was no red caps about, and get a ticket up to Clapham Common, one of those stations on the line, not avoiding the main stations. You could do that without fear of being detected. This went on all the time I was there, really. I went home several times, and but I got caught two or three times. But all they'd done was they give you so many days CB, and you lost whatever days you lost on parade, your pay was docked. But I was to regret this later on, because it played a big part in the rest of my career. In October, I think it was, we were posted back to our units, and I joined the depot battalion of the London Rifle Brigade at a place called Blackdown, near Aldershot. That was the camp, and here we used to do the usual drills and parades and duties. Just before Christmas, and a pal of mine, a chap named Dickens, we used to call him Dicko, he lived in Walthamstow the same as I did. And we powered up together. So we put in for leave on just before Christmas. But we were told we weren't going to be allowed any leave. But a lot of the chaps who were there, young fellas who'd never been out abroad and been in England all the time, were allowed Christmas leave. But so we got rather annoyed about this, and we decided to take the law into our own hands. So on Christmas Eve, we collected a few belongings and set off and walked, when it got dark, walked to a place called Virginia Water. It was snowing at the time, I remember that. Must have been quite a number of miles, I forget now how many, but anyway, we got there and was able to catch a train back to London from there. But we got off at one of the stations before the main terminus so that we wouldn't be spotted by the red caps. We got off and arranged to meet later on, but I expect the unit had realised when the sergeant came round to call the roll, as they did every morning and every night, that we were missing, and of course we were posted as absent without leave. And after a few days, if you didn't return, they sent an escort, which they did, and I was picked up with an escort and taken back and put under arrest in the guard room, the same as the other chap. And then from then on, of course, my previous record and his were put on the charge sheet, so we were awarded a court-martial each. So we had to appear before the court-martial, and we were both given 56 days detention, which we spent in a place called Woking. It was an old civil prison turned into a military establishment.
Were you aware of the seriousness of going absent without leave?
Not really. As we'd been out abroad, we'd never been in trouble before. We just simply didn't care. We'd been through what was hell out in France and all that, and we were only too anxious to get home and see our parents and our friends. And we'd have done anything to do it. But being as they turned us down on our application, we just simply took matters into our own hands, you see.
What happened at the court-martial?
Well, we were asked why we went home, and we told them, and then they undenied and with themselves. Then the prosecuting officer produced our records. Well, of course, on the records was all these times we'd been caught and given CB for being bad before. So this weighed against us. And of course, you can't defy authority like we did without getting punished for it. So that's what we had to suffer.
Were you represented by anyone?
Yes, oh yes, but it didn't make any difference because all the evidence was against us. We didn't make any plea of any sort at all, only the fact that we thought it was wrong that people who'd never been out to France and suffered like we had were given leave where we wasn't. But then it was explained by the colonel, who was the head of the court-martial, that we weren't as soldiers, we weren't allowed to do that sort of thing, and we've got to suffer for it. It wasn't too bad in the prison during the time we spent there, and because after we'd come back from France, we could face any sort of thing like that. Then we returned to our unit, and this was about February 1918. We'd done a lot of training then and preparation for being posted abroad, which we were very quickly, because after anybody had ticked over the traces like we had in those days, you were on the first draft to go abroad again. And we found ourselves on a draft, and we were taken by train to Southampton again, put on a ship which took us over to Le Havre again. And from there we we done the usual train that we did before with the draft, and went up with the draft to no, we didn't go in a draft. There was only this chap and I. We were given a railway warrant and told where to go, and we put on the train. We had to report to certain people on the road, and but we eventually arrived at a place just outside Vimy Ridge. That's a place in front of ours, near where we'd been before. And we eventually arrived at, I was in post at the B Company again, and my pal, he was taken away and posted into another company. several things happened before we joined our unit. When we got to one place, it was just he and I, the RTO, that was the officer who conducts all the numerous troop movements, told us to board a train because Jerry used to shell this particular town, same as he had done ours, at certain times of the day. And all the inhabitants of this village or small town got onto this train at a certain time, and the train shunted out a few miles beyond the town. And then the Germans started shelling, and that only lasted about 10 minutes, and nobody seemed to have been injured, and the train shunted us back, and everything went back to normal again. Anyway, we eventually arrived at our battalion, and it was night time, because we were conducted through communication trenches and taken to, in my case, the headquarters of Big Company. And I remember going into it was a bit of a dugout, but not very deep down. And in there was a table, and the officer sitting at the table, and he was only a lieutenant, and he took our particulars, well, took mine anyway, and because the other chap had gone off on another to his other company. And one thing about I remember is when he asked me my number, and then he asked me my name, he said, "Well, that's rather funny." He said, your initials are SAA, which is Small Arms Ammunition, and your number is 303, which is the caliber of the ammunition. Anyway, that's just by the way. And then after that, I was taken to through various trenches and joined a lance corporal and four or five other chaps in what was a vast trench again. We were a couple of hundred yards or so in front of what was our original front line, and I spent the next 4 or 5 days and nights in this bay with these other people doing various things, but mostly standing on the fire step looking out at night, but then looking through what was an old periscope. It was only a box with a couple of mirrors attached to it, set up so that you could look at it without being seen by the enemy. Part of our job, we were so short-handed, and the line was so thinly held that I found out afterwards that we had to do 1 hour on the fire step, 1 hour sitting on the fire step and resting, and 1 hour patrolling. You had to go, this is only during darkness, patrol from our little bay about another 100 yards along to our left, And where there he would join with another man who'd come from another bay some distance away. So you were in touch with one another. During the time I was there, especially at night time, there was constant shelling by the Germans to our rear areas. And there was huge fires and explosions we could hear and see in the distance behind our lines. And we knew then that either our own people were blowing up our ammunition dumps or the Germans were hitting them with their shell fire. I didn't know at the time, but I learned afterwards that I was one of a platoon which was left behind while the rest of the battalion retired 3 miles away to what was called the Blue Line, just outside Arras, and we were the sacrificed troops. This we didn't know at the time, but that's just by the way. There was only 30 men, NCOs and men, left behind to hold a 400-yard front. The Germans never shelled our particular trench, our advanced trench at all. They shelled all the rear areas, all the reserve trenches, and everything was going up. Tremendous noise all through the night. Very lights going up all over the shop. And on the fifth night, it was worse than ever. Or rather, the fourth night. But on the fifth morning, the shell fire suddenly ceased. And we stood to, as we always did at the dawn, and on looking round, we could see the Germans a few hundred yards away setting up their trench mortars. These were unlike the British trench mortars. There was a large cannon-shaped arrangement, and this threw a big shell about as big as a dustbin, full of explosive, and the idea was it wasn't so much to injure people as to knock the trenches out. And these things came over, and you could see them going in the air with the sparks of the trailing behind them. They went up a few hundred feet and then in a curve came down, and they usually came, instead of coming down straight where you'd think they'd come, they either went to the left or the right. And this was realised by all our troops in those days, and they used to shout out, many right or many left, and you'd go the opposite way to dodge it. They certainly done their job, these Germans. Although we fired at them with our rifles and tried to dissuade them from this, these mortars came over, and the whole of our trench system, as we'd known it before, was all one mass of shell holes and fallen earth. Then a runner must have come up and told the Lance Corporal, giving him instructions that we were to retire. And as we went back to past our old front line, we heard soldiers calling out where they'd been. The bomb had threw all the earth up and buried them right up to their necks. And we stayed behind in some cases and tried to get them out. But as we looked over, we saw that the Germans had advanced right on our left flank and our right, and they were right behind us, hundreds of yards away. But eventually we arrived at what had been a reserve trench, and there was a dugout there, and we saw a sergeant of the machine gun corps, and he told us to go down the dugout out the way of the shell fire, which they started again. We all bundled down this dugout, and when we got down there, we saw an officer, and he's also machine gun corps. Anyway, the sergeant said, well, the next time you're relieved, you'll be relieved by the Germans. And Anyway, he made some coffee for us, but we hadn't been down there long. We left one man at the top as a sentry, the top of the dugout, and then he suddenly yelled down to us that the Germans were in a trench, and as we made ready to go up the steps, he came down and joined us. In fact, he was terrified. And the next thing I knew was we heard a German voice up above. And one of the chaps who was with us, he could speak German, or he knew a little bit about German. He said he's calling down that we've got to surrender. Anyway, the next thing we knew was the steps of this dugout was made with bits of wood from the ammunition boxes, and we heard a grenade come bouncing down the steps, and it was rather a terrifying experience to hear this bomb coming down, and we knew it was going to explode at the bottom or near there. Well, it did explode, but it didn't do much harm. The only thing is, there was a corporal down there, I found out, and he was splattered with a lot of small pieces of this grenade. But apart from that, everybody was else was all right. But this chap who could speak German said the German said if we was to come up with our hands up, we could drop our rifles and all our equipment, they'd take us prisoner. So. And when we got to the top, this corporal told us you were going to put your hands up and say Kamerad, which we did, because when we got to the top, I remember there was a big, our sergeant major type of person, they called an hunter officer, with a Luger pistol, and he pressed it into your ribs and looked at you, and if you said Kamerad or something like that, he'd nod you on, and then you went to up the trench, and you were all collected together, and eventually told to get on top of the trench, because apparently the Germans had taken the whole of this area, and there was no shell fire going on at that time. But when we got to the top of the trench, I looked round, and I was astonished to find that the whole area he'd occupied a few hours before was all swarming with Germans. There was all the roads and pathways that we'd occupied before. They had all their transport on there. The whole army was moving forward. Anyway,